Hello, you are tuning in to the inaugural relaunch of AASA, the School Superintendent Association's Public Education Policy Podcast, or PEP Talk for short. I am Kat Sturdivant. I am the AASA Advocacy and Governance Coordinator, and I'll be your producer at the top of each episode. So to kick off this new era of the podcast, we invited Sarah Abernathy, who is the Executive Director of the Committee for Education Funding here in DC, for a timely discussion on appropriations and education funding. This episode was such a good primer for education funding and how to be involved in your district as a superintendent. So without further ado, here's the episode on federal appropriations.
Hello, and welcome to PEP Talk, AASA, the School Superintendents Association Public Education Policy Podcast. We're really excited to have our first guest here today to be Sarah Abernathy, Executive Director for the Coalition for Education Funding. This is a national coalition of dozens of education groups covering the entire education spectrum committed to one simple cause, advocating for education funding. Now, getting that money is not simple, but the advocacy is unifying and simple. And we're here to put a little bit of the fun into the funding. I am Noelle Ellerson-Ing. I head up the advocacy and governance team. Our podcast is produced by Kat Sturdivant, the coordinator of our department, and we're joined for our first guest of the revamp of the podcast by Sarah Abernathy. We're going to jump right in and get started. For context setting, the annual appropriations process that we're talking about is for federal fiscal year 2024. This is the fiscal year that will start October 1st of 2023 and run through September 30th of 2024. Generally speaking, these FY24 dollars will be in the schools for the 24-25 school year. So another way to think about this is we are talking about the advocacy we are doing for the funding that will be in your schools for the next school year, not the school year you recently started. With that context in place, Sarah, before we can talk about what's going on in 2024, there's some additional stage setting we should do. Coming off of federal fiscal years 2022 and 2023, we saw big increases in funding for education. Adjusted for inflation, these levels are below that of 2011, but at the nominal level, they were sizable increases that are not at all on the radar for this year's discussions. Earlier this year was also the deal for raising the debt ceiling. What do our listeners need to know about what that deal included and what it means for FY24? Sarah?
That is a really good question, and thank you for having me on the podcast. I am always happy to talk about education funding and budget stuff because I am a budget geek. A lot of the information that I'm going to mention, I hope, is available on CEF's website, which is cef.org. We've got charts, we've got funding tables, we've got fact sheets. And this is always an odd time of the year because we're in calendar year 2023. We're finishing up fiscal year 23. We're talking about fiscal year 24. Schools are thinking about the 23-24 academic year that's just starting, but also planning for the next year. So there's a lot of overlapping years to think about. But current funding, which for the federal government expires on September 30th, and it represented a real high watermark for education funding. And it was a combination of Democratic Congress and a Democratic president that were both pushing very hard for education funding. And in fact, last year, Congress increased funding for the Department of Education by $3.9 billion. That is the largest dollar increase in years. If you don't count Pell Grant funding, which you obviously have to count, but in terms of looking for year-to-year changes, the way Pell Grants are funded doesn't reflect necessarily the amount of spending on Pell Grants. So often you pull that out of the total to see an apples-to-apples comparison. So not counting Pell Grant funding, the increase for fiscal year 23 was the largest in 21 years. But as Noelle mentioned, that still leaves the Department of Ed funding below the 2011 level in inflation-adjusted dollars. The largest in the current year funding, the largest increases were for the two largest K-12 education programs, Title I and Special Ed State grants, as well as for congressional earmarks, Title IVA grant, which funds a lot of different K-12 programs and full service community schools. The debt ceiling deal that Congress and the president reached in June of this year did a bunch of things that have nothing to do with raising the debt ceiling, although it did that as well. Two of the things that are really relevant for today's conversation are that it set levels of discretionary funding for fiscal year 24 and fiscal year 25. Discretionary funding is the appropriations that Congress set each year and doesn't include entitlement spending for programs like Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid, where anybody who is eligible and applies gets the funding regardless of whether the funding goes up or down in a given year. So discretionary spending in the deal set a path for a very challenging fiscal year 24. Non-defense discretionary funding, in other words, all appropriations except for defense funding, is basically frozen at the current level. And that's after you count a bunch of sort of gimmicky things like emergency funding, and you count some spending that was rescinded from the IRS and then set aside to be used to be spent again on other things. So it doesn't count as new spending, but it actually will support programs this coming year. And then some other budgetary changes that take funding from one account and put it in another. So adding all those outside things that aren't actually in the budget deal, but that were understood as part of a handshake, the total level of funding for non-defense programs, which is where education is really going to be the same as fiscal year 23. And in fiscal year 24, it only goes up a tiny bit. I'm sorry, 25. So that means it's going to be really hard to get increases for anything, education or any other program, because if the total funding is about the same, any increase has to be paid for by cutting something else. And that's where we are right now.
So I know that Sarah and I are excited now, but we're about to get to some of the drama. And as much as sometimes talking about appropriations can be the stuff that cures your insomnia, it's paying attention to these minutiae and engaging in advocacy that is very consequential this fall in a way that I would argue it hasn't necessarily been in previous years. Another way I like to talk about this inflation adjustment, for our current seniors, they were the kids who were kindergartners in 2011. The federal purchasing power is the same for them at each end of their K-12 experience. And that's the way you can talk about that at home with your communities as we sit and talk with Congress about what we need them to do. So as we've done kind of the dry, boring stuff about appropriations and stage setting, there's the Schoolhouse Rocks version of how appropriations works. The House and the Senate will introduce each of their 12 bills, because there's 12 slices of the budget pie, and then they would compromise on those and then vote on them. That's not how it's going to work. What's the elevator version, Sarah, of where we are in that budget and appropriations process for each of the chambers?
House and Senate are in different places, that's for sure. You would hope that with a month, I mean, literally a month from the time we're recording this to the day is when current government funding expires. And you would hope that House and Senate would have each passed their bills and then these compromise meetings would be happening. But instead, the Senate Appropriations Committee has passed 12 bipartisan government funding bills, but none has come to the Senate floor yet. The House has passed only one of the 12 bills and has passed 9 others through committee. None of them are at conference. They're not going to be done on time.
I think it's important to level set also that not finishing on time isn't unprecedented. So we're not saying that Congress is being a bad actor this year. I think the last time Congress finished its appropriations work on time and in normal order was the mid-1990s. So constant reliance on one of two mechanisms to keep Congress, to keep appropriations moving forward. There's either a federal shutdown, which, long story short, ends up costing sometimes billions of dollars, or a continuing resolution, which is where they just level fund every program and buy themselves more time. We like to describe this as the Motel 6 provision. We'll keep the lights on for you. So it won't be unusual if we see them exercising a continuing resolution or a shutdown. I'm going out of order on questions because that's what I do. But Sarah, if you were a gambling woman, and full disclosure, Sarah Abernathy is not a gambling woman, but if you were, what do you think? Do you have a read? Are you confident in which way we might be leaning in terms of shutdown or continuing resolution come October 1st?
I am not confident. I have gone back and forth from being sure that Congress would find a way to extend funding through the jargon we use, a continuing resolution or a CR. And in the last couple of weeks, the Speaker McCarthy and Senate Leader Schumer both started talking about the need to extend current funding probably until early December. So that would give Congress all of October and all of November to work out funding levels. However, I guess if I had to bet, I would bet that there would be a shutdown, but it would be very short. And I think what's going to happen, but I don't know about the timing, and of course I could be wrong, I think what's going to happen is that the House will pass some sort of continuing resolution that won't do just the lights on. What it will do will be half of a Motel 6. It will extend government funding, but cutting dramatically certain things for the next few months, which would be a fiasco to implement. It would be very hard to continue services, knowing you have to cut funding by half or a quarter or whatever for 4 months, but then might get funding new again. I think that's what the House will do, is pass a continuing government extension that dramatically cuts non-defense funding. And then the Senate's not going to pass it. And then they'll go back to the drawing board and the Speaker will say, well, we tried doing this very conservative proposal to cut spending. Let's do something that's less conservative on spending and come closer to extending current funding. But there may be a shutdown for a couple of days while both sides dig in their heels and argue and try to reach a compromise. And by both sides, I mean the fact that there are, particularly in the House, a number of conservative hardline Republicans who really want to dramatically cut non-defense funding. They want to cut it back down to below the level from 2 years ago. And that is not what is happening. That's not what Democrats want, so they won't support that. And in the Senate, which is a very narrow majority of Democrats, they have actually passed in the Appropriations Committee on a bipartisan basis 12 of government funding bills that do not dramatically cut non-defense funding. They are funded at about the level in the deal that we talked about earlier, plus some extra emergency funding. So they're actually more generous than the deal.
So we could see this action on the Hill, this nonstop entertainment news cycle, as a combination of two things, right? Both a little bit of the politics coming to play and checks and balances. And let's start to talk about both of those. So checks and balances are, again, part of that Schoolhouse Rock stuff that we heard about. And they're a good thing. But I can't help but think that in a year like this, where the House Republicans' budget for education is just like a knockoff of that famous children's book, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. Part of that play here is those very House Republicans who say they want these deep cuts, knowing their bill won't go anywhere and relying on the Senate to help them from keep them safe from themselves while also allowing them to deliver messaging to their base. And this gets in the way of their effort. So instead of trying to accomplish something like what the Senate was able to do or move something that could realistically get over a finish line, they're moving this budget because the Senate's going to save them. So I think there's a part of that at play. And the other thing that warrants consideration is that when you're starting with a bill proposal that is horrible, terrible, no good, and very bad for education, it still represents their entry into the conversation. And when we think about how anything going forward has to be a compromise, just because that compromise is going to make it less bad, when it is so very, very, very bad, less bad is still nowhere near good. How much weight do you think House Republicans are going to put behind this hyper-focus on cutting education?
I would characterize it as hyper-focus on cutting spending on non-defense, and that education happens to be one of, you know, falling victim to that. I don't know that they dislike education funding more than they dislike environmental funding or justice funding or other things. And to put it in perspective, I try really hard. You know, I love numbers, but I try really hard not to talk about numbers because a trillion is a lot and a billion is a lot and a million is a lot. But to put it in perspective, one of the two bills that has not moved through the House Appropriations Committee is the Labor, Health and Human Services Education Bill, the Labor H bill, we call it, that funds education. And I think that one of the reasons the Appropriations Committee in the House hasn't passed it is because it is a really bad bill. It's the largest non-defense bill, and it is overall cut by $60 billion. That's 30% below current funding. It is very hard to think of a third of the funding almost that you want to eliminate. The House Subcommittee Bill for Education, it has a $22 billion, 28% cut in Department of Ed funding. That is really unprecedented. The biggest cuts are to Title I, which is the the largest K-12 program. It's cut by $15 billion through a combination of new funding and rescinding funding that's already been enacted, eliminating the Title II teacher training program, saving almost $4 billion, eliminating some higher ed programs that save another $2 billion, eliminating English language acquisition funding. Those programs alone account for close to $20 billion of savings. And in contrast, the bill approved by the Senate Appropriations Committee basically freezes education funding with small boosts for early education programs in the Health and Human Services Department and Education's Special Ed and Title I, among a handful of other programs. There are small cuts somewhere else. But the fact is, you can't see my gesture, but you know, one bill freezes funding, one bill cuts Department of Ed by $22 billion. A compromise would be to cut $11 billion. That would be a horrible, unacceptable compromise. The proposal to cut $22 billion from the Department of Ed funding is unprecedented and is not going to be enacted. The question is, where does it end up landing? And I think that the House Republicans, I take them at their word. They want to cut funding for non-defense programs, and they don't really care where the funding is cut. A lot of folks will argue that education funding should be more a state and local priority and not a federal funding priority. But obviously, there's areas where the federal funds help make up for inequities. There are places where the federal funds lead the way to serve as seed money for other things. And there's places where the federal funds fill in new needs. And it is really important. And those needs existed before the pandemic. They were underfunded. Department of Ed was underfunded for years when there were spending caps in place. Basically 2012 through 2021, that's when education funding really suffered for years. It was actually cut in nominal dollars. And the reason Noelle and I were talking about the 2011 level kept pace with inflation is that for many years had been the high watermark of funding for Department of Ed programs. And you know, my goal is not to return to the 2011 level of services. The need for services has dramatically increased since then. My goal is to far exceed the 2011 level, but we're not there yet.
There's so much to talk about and follow up there. And the one I will start with is, we're going to get to this at a later question, but the timing of the FY24 dollars in districts is especially consequential because, as we talked about, a lot of those dollars will hit in September of 2024. That's the deadline, the final spend down for the ARP dollar. So that ESSER cliff, if this House Republican funding cliff comes in, is going to be a doubling down on very bad cuts. To what we were talking about with the House Republican proposal, it's a nuance that sometimes seems without a distinction, but I think it's very relevant here. To what you were saying, Sarah, I don't think we need to take them literally that they want to cut education, but I do think we need to take them seriously that they want deep cuts. And strategically, as we start to get to the advocacy side of this, that's something that has to be front of mind. Fun fact, before Sarah was directing a national coalition that's just really the bomb about federal appropriations, she was a staffer on the budget committee, and a young Noelle used to lobby Sarah, and she was very gracious about those meetings. But when we think about the strategy, one of the things that Kat will be linking to on the page when we release this resource, we talk all the time about the need to increase Title I, the need to increase IDEA. And when we're having those conversations with allies, great. But at the same time, if I go into some of these House Republican offices as an advocate serving superintendents and say, you need to increase Title I, I'm not being effective or efficient because I know where they are and it's not wanting to increase Title I. So what we did was we accessed a data set that looked at both the district level, school district level, and congressional district level, and ran an analysis to see what proportion of a school district budget is reliant on federal dollars. So we're not talking about absolute cuts. We're just saying this is the percentage of districts in your state that have a way above average reliance on federal dollars, and then they can fill in the blank for the rest of that. And the states that have more than half of their districts really relying on federal dollars tend to be where a lot of these House Republicans are coming from. So strategically, it allows us to talk about, hey, here's how reliant your districts are on federal dollars. And it's not just enough to look at where Title I is. Let's look at which districts in your state are going to be really hit here. And is this really something you want to lock into? So we'll be sharing both the congressional district and local district maps with this podcast episode. We already talked about predictions of finishing this on timeline. Let's come in from left field with another very wonky provision that was in that debt ceiling package, this sequester. What do our listeners need to know about this looming sequester, and how does that sequester factor into the timeline consideration for when Congress might finalize its appropriations work? Not a vote on a CR, but like put a bow on FY24.
So I'm like rubbing my hands because it's budget geek time. So sequestration is in the budget world means pulling money back that has already been promised. Or sometimes what it means, Sometimes it's affected, put into effect by lowering spending caps. And the budget deal as part of the stick part of the carrot stick for getting funding bills done said, if any part of the government is operating on doesn't have full year funding in place by January 1st. So in other words, it's still operating on a continuing resolution, then the non-defense and the defense caps are lowered by 1%. And that would be 1% doesn't sound like much, but it would have the effect of having Congress have to go back and redo the bills they're still working on or implement a 1% across the board cut to everything, which in fact is not, you know, if you have a budget yourself and you suddenly have to spend less, you don't decide to spend 1% less on food and 1% less on rent. You decide to spend lots percent less on entertainment and keep your food and rent budgets where they have to be. And so it's not a good way to do things. I frankly don't think that this is going to be much of an incentive because the people who are likely to be most difficult about approving government funding bills want to cut spending anyway. And the sequestration, you know, the trigger is January 1st, but it really wouldn't be implemented until the end of April. So it really gives Congress until the end of April, in essence, to get full year funding and done. And full year funding could just be Congress throwing its hands up and saying, you know what, let's just continue all funding at current rates minus 5% or at current rates or whatever they want to do. It doesn't have to be individual bill by bill. So I'm not too worried about the sequester. It's just one more complicated thing to think about and maybe plan for, but it's far in the future. I believe members of Congress live, they live a little bit, you know, not just year to year in terms of appropriations, but week to week. Like, what do I have to do to get the ball rolling for the next week? And I think what the Congress comes back in September, the House right after the Senate, right after Labor Day, and the House a week later, and they have a couple weeks to get appropriations done some way to get keep the government running. And I think that they're not worried about a sequester. They're worried about what do they do to prevent a shutdown or if there's a shutdown to keep it very short. Shutdowns, as Noel mentioned, are bad for the economy. They're bad for the government. They're bad for the people. They're also bad for politicians. They don't reflect well on the Congress or the White House, regardless of who's in power. They don't reflect well on Democrats or Republicans. Nobody thinks it's a good idea when Congress and the administration fail to successfully keep the government funded. So my hope is that there will either be no shutdown or it'll be very short and that cooler heads will prevail. And really, they will then move back to their week to week looking. If they extend government funding for a couple months, then they have 2 months to figure out a solution and they'll procrastinate a little bit more, or each of them will put forward each side will put forward the things that they want and see what the reception is from the other side. It's a lot of posturing, but it's also politics. This is what happens. People put forward what they want and what they believe in, and then they see how to reach a compromise. And in essence, you know, compromise is a solution that no one is really happy with, but both sides can live with.
It's just somewhat ironic that we're sitting here on a podcast that's designed for school system leaders who have to balance a budget on time every year. And here we are talking about Congress consistently abdicating on its one constitutional responsibility. This is the only thing they're required to do every year, right? Is pass a budget or pass the funding to keep the government running. It's a fun punchline to make, but as I mentioned earlier, it's not necessarily fair because there's a lot at play here. And I'm totally off script, so thank you, Sarah, for rolling with this. But I think something that's worth adding for our listeners here is in the recent environment, there aren't a lot of major bills that get over the finish line, right? So here we are, there's no other bills moving in the finish line. Policy riders sometimes further weigh down appropriations pressures. Do you want to share some thoughts on that, about what that does or how that complicates getting bills over the finish line, both in terms of your perspective as a coalition executive director, as well as having been the committee staff on the receiving end of all these calls and all this pressure?
Good question. If Congress is going to pass one thing, then everyone looks at that one thing and says, I want to get the thing I care most about in that. And sometimes it's funding, and sometimes it's a change in government policy regarding something that has nothing to do with funding. It may have, well, or tangentially, it may have to do with a border wall or abortion policy or environmental protection. And those so-called policy writers can often weigh down an appropriations bill. And usually, I mean, if you had to bet, you would probably bet at the end of the year that they don't include controversial policy writers. Because if you are measuring the ability to get a bill passed, I mean, the House and Senate has a majority of 2 if everyone is available. The House has a majority, Republican majority of 4 if everyone is available. They cannot afford to alienate more than one person or 3 people. And so if putting in something controversial will cost the bill some votes, they're not going to do it. So probably you won't at the end see a lot of big changes from current law policy. And not everyone likes current law policy, but it's the easiest, lowest denominator. But there's so many different things that are difficult for about appropriations bills. Funding levels overall, fundings for individual programs, policy riders, the politics of who needs to make a point about something. If enough people happen to be away because they're sick, then you suddenly can't pass a bill that otherwise would pass. I mean, it is really hard to get anything passed through a divided Congress as we have now, especially with slim majorities in both the House and Senate. You could look this year at the 118th Congress and know this was going to be a challenge. And then you have the new spending level set in law that really, ironically, no one likes for fiscal year 24. Generalizing tremendously, Democrats think that the non-defense funding level is too low, and Republicans think the non-defense spending level is too high. And so it is complicated. It is hard to do. And, you know, it's not that the September 30th deadline for funding sneaks up on people. They know it's there, as you mentioned, happily for almost every K-12 program. The funding that they will get in this coming bill won't be released until July 1st of next year. But that is not true for higher education funding. It is not true for job training programs or Head Start or other education-related programs. I tend to use Department of Ed funding as a proxy for education funding, but there's certainly education funding that exists outside of the Department of Ed. And it is very, how do you plan a program if you don't know what your funding level is going to be going forward? How do you provide services to students if you only have funding for 1 week at a time, or 8 weeks if the continuing resolution goes till early December? I mean, you can't sign a lease for the year for your childcare program if you're going to support it with federal funds because you only have funding for 2 months. It's not a good way to govern, but it's a way that has been happening recently, because it's hard to pass appropriations bills anyway. But also over the last maybe 10 years, a lot of the, if you look at a range of very liberal Democrats and then conservative Democrats sort of in the middle, and then moderate Republicans sort of in the middle and conservative Democrats at the other end, a lot of the conservative Democrats have lost their seats, and a lot of the moderate Republicans have lost their seats. And what you're left with is people at both ends. And it's very hard to compromise when there's no one in the middle to negotiate or create that big clump of people supporting.
It's much less collaborative now. We saw that gutting of the middle. The moderates are gone, and they might compromise, but in compromising, those further apart ends still aren't close together. One of the things that I think puts in context here, we're talking about FY24. In 23, this isn't an election year. I don't think there's anything about the appropriations process that necessarily makes next year any easier. And I think that warrants some consideration. And one of the final things I want to talk about, we're sitting here before our member organization, AASA, hoping maybe a few other people are listening. We're going to ask them to advocate. And my team is very, very cautious about when we do a full field engagement, because any minute they spend on our advocacy is a minute that they're not in their buildings, in their classrooms, with their teachers, with their students. So we're very mindful to be efficient. This is a full court press. And we've talked with the superintendents about how they're a highly efficient meeting because yes, they can talk about their district impact, but they can also talk about broader employment trends, broader health trends. Has a major employer left? Have you had a significant health scare? Have you seen another demographic shift that's broader than just your school district? So telling them the importance of weighing in. But for anyone who's listening to us now, Sarah, as a coalition director and a former Hill staffer, there truly is importance in their voice. And what are the different ways that they can engage with what they have and where they are and what their time allows?
I am glad you asked that question. So Committee for Education Funding, we have 114 different members, and you know, AASA is one of them. And each of them focus on different parts of the education continuum and different programs. We love them all equally. So we don't say we want funding for this program over that program. But what we want people to do is tell members of Congress why education funding matters to them. And the fact is, no matter how effective Noelle and Kat and I might be from within DC talking about numbers and programs and stats, what members of Congress care about most is what their constituents have to say. And if you can invite them on a field trip, come visit your school, come visit your community center, or your childcare center, that is really impactful. It's so much more than the words, but the words are also helpful. You don't have to write them a letter. You don't have to be formal. You can tweet at them, or you can use another form of social media if Twitter is no longer your thing. CEF has a social media toolkit, and I know Noelle is going to put some information about what you're doing as well, but we have something called hashtag Hear Our Ed Stories, and it's on our website, cef.org, under advocacy, and it has a way to look up who your members of Congress are, and we have a list of all their Instagram and Twitter and Facebook pages, and if you can just tell them, we have some sample scripts, like, I care, I'm a parent in school district, whatever. And I'm telling you that my kid is getting a great education, but I know those teachers are having to put money in, and I know they could do more. And I know the classes could be smaller if federal funding was increased. And that's why I think it's really important. That's all you have to do. And then tag them on Twitter and share your story. And I think that they care much more. You can call them, you can call their district office locally, you can call their Washington office. It doesn't have to be a formal request with lots of data. Although if you want to do that, that's also fine too. But I think letting them know that you care about this is really key, because the squeaky wheel does get the oil.
And one of the best things you can remember when you're a professional advocate is they can't tell you no until you ask. And on some of these questions, they might not be paying as much attention as you think. And so you could be that beacon of light on an issue or a specific program that they didn't realize was in their state or in their congressional district. So you miss all the shots you don't take, whatever metaphor you want to put in here. Make the ask. And if you're busy doing the whole I run a school system thing, these are member benefits. People belong to coalitions like CEF for smart analysis. I don't read 500 page bills the way I used to have to before Sarah was the executive director. She provides detailed analysis that really powers our work. Similarly, you don't need to read 500 page analysis. You can say, Noelle, Sasha, Tara, Kat, I need three talking points on FY24, nutrition. It's literally what you pay for when you participate in coalitions and orgs. So never hesitate to recognize and engage in that member benefit. I'm looking at time now, and I'm always appreciative of my friend's time. But I have one more question, Sarah. As we close out, and we're very grateful for your time and expertise and insight and the work you do to support education advocacy for funding, we got to close out on a COVID note, because are you even talking education funding if we're not talking about the looming deadline for spending down the elementary and secondary school emergency relief, ESSER, funding? How do you anticipate the end of this COVID relief funding impacting education and or these fiscal conversations?
I think it's already impacting the fiscal conversations even before it ends. And in fact, part of the rationale that House Republicans put for their dramatic cut in Title I in their proposed bill for next year was, well, there's so much COVID relief funding that hasn't been spent yet. And I think it's really important for superintendents, teachers, anyone who has this information and is willing to share it, to talk about the fact how COVID relief funding was designed for different things than ongoing programs that have been underfunded before. The COVID relief funding has been almost entirely, 99.9% obligated from the federal level to the states, but it obviously has not all been spent from the states to the districts or districts to writing checks. For instance, if you had 3 years to spend money and you decided to provide summer school for 3 years, you haven't spent the third year of summer school yet because it hasn't happened. It's not a problem with the lack of funding or doesn't reflect the lack of need. It reflects the plan of how schools wanted to use the funding and decided at the local level what best met their needs. But there's this erroneous sense that there's extra COVID relief spending that some people have. But the reality, when the funding is gone and there's no extra funding beyond what is provided through the annual appropriations, it's once again back to the combination of local, state, and federal funding to support teaching and learning. And the federal share has just not kept up. I have a chart, but that doesn't help on a podcast. But the federal funding has barely increased over the last decade, except for in K-12 funding. So post-secondary has really literally been flat in nominal dollars. And the K-12 part really only started increasing when the spending caps were gone in 22 and 23. And now we have spending caps back in place for 24 and 25. And the trouble is needs weren't frozen while the funding was. And states during the Great Recession in 2008, 2010, weren't really in a great place to dramatically increase their state funding. In fact, they were often cutting funding. It took some states 10 years to return to the level of the pre-recession funding. The COVID recession is a different beast, but the needs have only grown. And I think that you're going to see a whole bunch of things happening at once. Federal spending caps in place that are super tight, COVID relief money being used up. And I don't think states and federal budgets are going to be able to expand to fit new needs. So I think that any advocacy we can do now to keep the ball rolling for education funding is important, because next year will be at least as challenging.
It might not be the happiest notes to close on, but realism is the name of the game if you're going to try to be successful here. So that concludes this episode of Pep Talk podcast on federal appropriations. Thank you, Sarah, for joining us. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And don't hesitate to reach out to me and Kat with your feedback. We're here to make Pep Talk a repeat listen. Have a good day.
And that's a wrap on this episode of AASA's Pep Talk podcast. We invite you to share it by using the hashtag Pep Talk on Twitter. You can access past episodes in the Pep Talk library by visiting aasapeptalk.podbean.com. And once again, thank you for joining us.